Yes, good evening, and welcome to the June 20th school board meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. We were in closed session prior to this, and in closed session, we considered a public employee performance evaluation for the superintendent. We had a conference with labor negotiators for two unrepresented employees who are our assistant superintendents, and we also had a student personnel matter, a stipulated expulsion hearing. Do we have consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Everyone seems like everyone is in agreement. Item number 4.02 is taking an action on the stipulated student discipline agreement.
I'll move approval of the stipulated agreement as presented.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that passes 7-0. We have the approval of the minutes of June 6, 2017.
Move approval of the minutes of June 6, 2017.
And it looks like everyone was present at that meeting. This was a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. 7-0. And going back to the last item, we're now moving on to the approval of minutes for June 14th, 2017. That was the special board agenda expulsion hearing.
I'll move approval of those minutes, June 14, 2017.
I'll second.
And we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Quisenberry. And Mr. Buckman and Mr. Millar were not present at that meeting. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That's 5-0 and two abstentions. And now we move on to the minutes of June 15th, 2017. That was the Measure D study session.
I'll move approval. I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry and a second by Mr. Unger. I'm sorry, Mr. Buckman. And Mr. Millar was absent. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Passes 6-0, 6-1 with Mr. Millar abstaining. And now we move on to correspondence at the time of this, agenda was published. There was no official correspondence. Is there anyone who would like to report correspondence they might have received? Seeing no one, we move on to public comment. This is an opportunity for anyone from the public to bring something to the board if they wish. If there's anyone like to make a comment? Seeing no one, we will move on to the business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so we're anxiously kind of waiting the state budget information. So Julie is going to be heading down to school services, kind of budget recap as they have it. I'm going to be attending another one here at the County Office of Education, kind of see where we landed in terms of the state budget. Looks like we are going to receive some one-time dollars this coming year, more than what we had anticipated when the board passed the budget earlier in the month, which is a positive sign. And yet we're still also waiting on the federal dollars in terms of what's going to happen there with Title I, Title II, Title III. So, we'll let the board know as that information comes out. So other than that, in terms of departments, transportation, summer school's kicked off, so kids moving, getting to school, which is great. Erin's going to give her update on food service department. A lot of summer work kicks in, so while the schools kind of die down, a big portion of our maintenance and facilities team really ramp up during the summertime. So a lot of things happening over the course of summer and trying to get everything in by the time school's over. Or school's back in session, I'd say summer's over.
Mr. Quisenberry?
I just want to affirm that as long as I have been in this district, I'm always impressed by the work that the custodial staff and building grounds and maintenance accomplish over the summer. It's phenomenal.
Thank you.
And they work very, very hard.
Yes, they do.
And the other one was just a quick answer for you, if you can. Mm-hmm. Any more movement on releasing some of that bond money? in terms of the...
So still kind of waiting for the... They haven't... And that's part of the governor's budget, I think, in terms of how they're moving. So they did put some new audit requirements in that it looks like they're going to move forward. So we're still looking at the fall.
All right. Thank you.
So, Mr. Pinkerton, you said there were more dollars released. How many more dollars were released?
Oh.
The state...
I don't think it's set yet.
In the one-time money?
It's not totally established, but I want to say how much per student? But it was like $150, $160
a student. Okay. So. We'll take that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mrs. Roger.
Did Mrs. Lang say three times more than we had anticipated? I couldn't hear well.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Lang. And moving on to the education services update, Mrs. McGrath.
Thank you. We have summer school in full swing, including extended school year. So for both of those programs, we have our high school students that we chose not to use the physical facilities of the high schools because of a lot of construction and things going on. So both of the high schools are conducting their summer schools for both credit recovery and original credit at the matching middle school, as well as the middle schools have a summer experience going on as well. So the middle schools are quite happening places this summer. And we also have Hawthorne, Bishop's Peak, Baywood, and Pacheco that are conducting elementary summer school. And at all four of those sites, we do have the food bank providing free lunches to the students as well as the siblings and their families available there. So as well as many neat camps you can see going on in our district as well. So you'll see some great sports camps going on, as well as robotics camps, et cetera. So some great enrichment opportunities for students and families as well. Also do just a quick kudos to IS&T. Technology is really working hard and making a lot of improvements and helping sites along during the summertime. So thanks to technology as well.
That is great news. During leaner times, we've not had as many opportunities in the summer for summer school, so that is great news. And moving on to Measure D update.
So, yeah, tomorrow actually is, or Thursday, I should say, is going to be a, kind of an exciting day for us. ACME Construction Company has kind of the DD phase of both Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School completed. So they're going to be presenting that to us, which I will then be sharing with the board at a future meeting, kind of going through the entire site, all the design build projects. So it's a critical point because it's a place where now they can do some estimating, construction estimating, where we can get a much better feel in terms of the overall budget for our projects. And so along with our lease-leaseback project. So having that overview, making sure we're on the right path, you know, it's taking a little bit of extra time to get to where we're at, but I think the planning is going to pay off in the long run for us. We're also going to be bringing the board forward some, you know, hopefully, I believe the week of July 11th, possibly the board study session, we have some GMPs for a couple of summer projects to move forward. So unfortunately, they weren't able to be bid out by tonight's meeting, but our plan is to hopefully bring those to you and get those projects underway this summer as well.
Terrific. Thank you. And moving on to item number 7.01. This is a resolution, a delegation of signature authority. It's being presented by Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so this is just the annual resolution that we ask the board to approve, and it basically outlines who can sign for documents with the district, so warrants, purchase orders, those types of things. And so Mrs. Holmes can pull it up for you. Show you the name. So with Mr. Robinette's retirement, Mrs. McGrath coming into that position, it lists the individuals who are able to sign for those documents. So we're just asking the board to approve that resolution tonight, and this will establish the names for next fiscal year.
Mr. Millar?
I am prepared to move if you wanted to check with the public.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this matter? Seeing no one.
I would move resolution 36-16-17, delegation of signature authority.
I'll second.
There's a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. This is a roll call vote.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Okay. Yes, I will do that. Sorry for the sidebar. We were just discussing that we were going to make a blanket announcement that there is no one from the public in the audience at the moment. And if someone should come in, we'll start going to the public, and that will be our protocol for tonight. Thank you, Mrs. Roger. And we have item number 7.02.
So, yeah, the purpose of the next item is we're trying to be as transparent as possible in terms of our environmental impacts on our sites with Measure D and construction. One of the aspects, and you'll actually see at the consent agenda, we've kind of outlined tree replacement and kind of what we're doing in those areas. We have a whole list of all of our environmental standards and how we uphold environmental standards as we move forward with construction. So one of the key aspects in moving forward with construction projects is for people to understand that we are not necessarily bound by city ordinances, that we're actually a state organization that has local jurisdiction. And so we looked back, talked to our attorney about it, and actually in 1977, the board approved a resolution which basically said, hey, the district is not bound to city ordinances when moving forward with construction on their sites. So in order to be as transparent as possible, we felt it was best for the board to update that resolution tonight. So it's not, oh, yeah, we pulled it out of 1977. It's something that's applicable, today's date type of thing.
You and me, Walter.
So that's why the resolution is in front of you tonight. Again, we have a whole list of standards, and actually the what's on the consent agenda, the tree replacement, is actually the same tree replacement that the city asks. So it's not that we're necessarily opposed to or different than the city ordinances, but it's for us, we do CEQA documentation. We just do it a different way than necessarily just going straight by what the city says.
Mr. Quisenberry?
Just a comment, and then I'll move the resolution. So this is sort of, we are sort of autonomous in some respects.
Yes.
And as I read through this, we're also very aware of our presence in the community and how things that we do affect the entire community, whether it's the city of Morro Bay or the city of San Luis.
Absolutely.
Whatever. Okay. Having said that, I move resolution 37-16-17.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
There is a motion by Mr. Quisenberry and a second by Mr. Unger, and this is a roll call vote.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Aye.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Passes 7-0.
And we're moving on now to item number 8.01. We're getting a little punchy, and we're moving on to this very wonderful presentation that we're about to have by Mrs. Shields.
Wow, way to set the bar high for me. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mrs. Holmes. Before I share our end-of-year elementary achievement data with you, I wanted to think back for a minute about how we got here. So elementary common assessments, as you know, have evolved in San Luis Coastal over the past 6 years as we transition to new standards, new curriculum, and more rigorous instruction. Our common assessments have been designed to meet three different purposes. First of all, we measure and report student achievement on Common Core standards over time. We measure program effectiveness, and we provide consistency in measuring student progress. The results from our common assessments provide data that can be used for grade level, school-wide, and district-wide conversations focused around improving student outcomes. In the board packet, and I decided to make you a hard copy as well for your reference tonight, you'll find data from our common assessments in reading, writing, and mathematics. I included a description of each of the assessments and an analysis of our end-of-year results. For each subject area, the results are shared by grade level as well as identified student group. For my student report tonight, I thought I would share with you district-wide results showing multi-year trends. Just take a look at where we've grown in the areas of reading, math, and writing. So we're going to begin with reading. Our kindergarten through second grade graders, as you know, are assessed with the Benchmark Assessment System, or BAS. The results you're seeing show a three-year comparison of student performance. 78% of our kindergarten through second grade students met end-of-year proficiency in reading, which stayed consistent from the prior year. So, in fact, in answer to an earlier question, we didn't meet the actual LCAP goal, which was a 5% growth, but we've seen that consistency over time, whereas 1 year, you're going to see some ups and downs, but we're still on that upward track. We'd hope to see it more. I did notice when I looked at the data that you have in front of you, a dip in first grade scores this year and higher than usual kindergarten scores. When I looked at last year's data, our kindergarten students had a lower percentage of proficiency as well. And so what that tells me is we're going to need to pay close attention to next year's second graders. So this has been a cohort group that was a little low last year, remains lower than the other grades this year, and so we want to make sure we pay close attention to them at the beginning of second grade. I think moving forward, we're going to look at site by site, look at the needs of specific students, and get our leveled literacy intervention in place where needed right at the beginning of the school year. Our third through sixth grade students take the Scholastic Reading Inventory, or SRI, three times a year. Our spring three-year comparison shows you that 72% of our students met or exceeded proficiency expectations, which is up 1% from 2016. I think it's important to share with you that last week we had over 150 teachers and principals who attended a four-day reading institute aligned to our new reading curriculum. Our focus right now is all about reading. I'm confident that we'll continue to experience gains in reading achievement as our teachers grow in their expertise in reading with this complex curriculum, similar to what I'm about to show you in writing. And here is our four-year writing growth. Okay?
I'm sorry, questions.
Sure.
Do you mind if you pause in between and we'll just ask questions as we go along? Thank you, Mr. Millar.
Amy, I wanted to note to make sure I understood a sentence kind of at the beginning of the presentation. I think I do, but it's at the elementary common assessments, the last sentence, as we continue to adopt and implement Common Core aligned curriculum, we will identify related curriculum embedded assessments as our elementary district common assessments. So why don't you tell me what that means?
Absolutely. So we currently, for reading, we use the benchmark assessment, which is developed by Fountas and Pinnell, who are two famous researchers. We use it with our Heinemann or Lucy Calkins reading program. That reading program comes with its own set of assessments, but we didn't want to abandon what we've started with the benchmark assessment system. In addition, we also use the Scholastic Reading Inventory in third through sixth. The reason we use that is because it's a quick and dirty dipstick for teachers that they use three times a year. It's computer-based. There's no scoring. They get the results immediately. It may not be the perfect assessment aligned to our now-adopted reading curriculum program, but we're going slowly before we change up another assessment. Okay. But when I get to writing and when I get to math, our assessments are totally aligned to our curriculum. Okay. I'm really glad you asked that question.
And then, that's good. That's a good answer. I was kind of thinking that's as we progress and learn and develop more targeted and aligned assessments.
Yeah.
On the BAS diagram on page 3 of the handout, can you explain to me why the RFEF students did so amazingly well? In that one, 93% meets or exceeds, 7% approaches.
I can give you my thinking on that. These are students in either kindergarten, first, or second grade who began as English learners and who have already been reclassified as fluent bilingual students. So potentially these are students who came with quite a bit of English when they arrived in kindergarten, but these are students who have been redesignated. They are now fluent in two languages, may potentially be academically high. They are, you know, literate in two languages, potentially. It's a group of students that we've seen great success in. What it also tells me is these students were reclassified appropriately. You know, when we reclassify students and they drop, we reclassified them too early. This tells me we've gotten an appropriate group. And you can also see for the whole district, that represents only 43 students.
Ah, that also...
Yeah.
Okay, and then I've noticed that as you get farther in the presentation, you don't see that dramatic result, but that explains why. Thank you, Amy.
Of course. All right, so let's
Amy,
take...
Is it okay?
Of course, I didn't see the red light.
So I truly appreciate your talking with me and getting me some answers. Let me just get back to where I was thinking. So I always ask about the cohort, and you've talked about that. And I'm a little concerned because what I remember from working with you and other administrators is that reading well by the end of the third grade is often an indicator of future performance. And as my understanding, the state also uses that number for building prisons, how many beds they should put in. I'm not sure quite why, but that's my understanding. So is there a direct effort, and what are we doing to make sure all of these groups are up by the end of third grade?
Well, I would start by saying we're paying a lot of attention to these students. We're placing our best and our brightest. We're providing ongoing professional development for teachers. We're monitoring their progress every trimester through the benchmark assessment and other assessments that we have in place that not only support taking a really close look at these students' literacy skills, but also inform our standards-based report card. You have allocated through the LCAP $15,000 per site to fund early literacy intervention through the Level Literacy Intervention Program. That provides us ongoing teaching support, professional development for those teachers. I think when I see, when we knew we were going to be losing our reading recovery program, we took advantage of the skill set that we had in Mary Zurm and spent a lot of time providing professional development for our principals in looking at, analyzing, and using data from these early learners to inform not only grouping in our primary classrooms, but early intervention.
Okay. And then I've been really fortunate to go to some of the math nights and some of the science nights and just been totally impressed by the parents just getting it by the end of the night. And what I didn't realize is I guess there's two places in the scheme of things where we actually work on literacy. Can you?
Sure. As part of each of our Success for All preschools, we have a fall parent education night in each of those, and it's actually a mandatory night for preschool parents where they learn about our Raising a Reader program. This is a parent involved with the red bags that go home every week, and parents are given ideas and structures and strategies for how to read with their child, how to cuddle up to a book, kinds of questions, things like that to ask to promote literacy. And then at several of our schools, it hasn't been a requirement in the last few years, but several of our elementary schools, in particular Title I schools, include a literacy night as part of their parent education opportunities. I was able to attend one earlier this year at Monarch Grove, and it was basically a reading camp where kids came and they had marshmallows and all of the hot chocolate and I would say about a 10-minute mini lesson for the parents, the importance of reading your child, the importance of having that time every day, and then they ended with blankets and pajamas and lots of fun reading. So
well,
I'd be happy to give you invites to that next year.
And so within those, I'm assuming, again, because this is what I've learned from you guys, that the emphasis is that reading is the foundation for for everything.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Mr. Quisenberry.
And I just want to add a comment on that. Some of the Raising and Reader books that come home are bilingual, so it's really quite interesting seeing in the case of my grandson where he's reading the English, but he's also picking up a little bit of the Spanish too. So it's a wonderful program. I think it's a very worthwhile investment.
Okay, so let's take a peek at writing. So this chart shows you our student growth in writing over the past 4 years. And I'm happy to report that we continue to see growth by our students in meeting grade level expectations. In the past 3 years, we've grown from 44 to 65% of our students meeting end of year proficiency, a 21% growth. You can see we did not meet our LCAP goal of 5% this year. We gained a 2%, but I still believe that we're on this steady path towards, it's like the higher you get, the harder it is to make that kind of growth. I think we are continuing to move in the right direction. I also think that there's no doubt the increases in student achievement in writing is directly due to teacher experience and expertise in teaching our writing units. And for our students, the increased time and experience that they're spending in the classroom writing. And I believe that a well-coordinated, which is what we now have, reading and writing program will only strengthen our student outcomes, not only in reading, but also in writing. Any questions?
Is there
on that?
A question here? I think it was resolved.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
I
just want to be open to questions here. So we'll finish up with math. So math is one of those areas, Mr. Millar in particular, that we didn't have a curriculum embedded assessment, and we were using things that we got from the Silicon Valley Math Initiative, and we were developing our own. Well, now that we are in year two or year three, depending on the grade level of our math adoption, our assessments are completely aligned with our curriculum. We actually took their assessments and I would say transitioned them a little bit to match our trimester system. So with that, this is that third year of implementation of Bridges Math for our kindergarten through second graders and second year of implementation for third through fifth graders. So how'd we do? Our end of year data shows that 70% of our kindergarten through fifth grade students are meeting or exceeding grade level expectations, which is up 4% from the prior year. Grade level data indicates higher percentages of students who met or exceeded grade level expectations in kindergarten through second grade, where we actually saw percentages between 77 and 80%. This may in part be due to the third year of implementation for those teachers. As students have continued exposure in our Bridges curriculum and teachers grow in their understanding and efficacy around teaching and the curriculum, I, again, expect to see the percentage of students meeting an exceeding standard increase. And I would end my formal presentation by saying it's going to be very interesting to compare the results for our third through fifth grade students with district CASP results that are beginning to trickle in when they completely become available. I believe we're going to see similar like gains for our students in mathematics as well. So with that, I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes, thank you. I have a couple of questions. First of all, when looking at the K through 6 in both writing, reading the on-demand writing and the math, there's a lot of, appears to be quite a bit of variation among grade levels. And what's your opinion as to why there isn't a steadier, you know, why those numbers aren't more similar?
Well, let's start with writing. And if you look at the graph on page 4, and if you look at the green, notice you see sort of a line that goes up. And I would say that is a direct cause and effect of the higher kids get up in the levels, the more difficult it is to reach proficiency, and the less number of years our students have had in the writing curriculum. It's rigorous, it's demanding, and we're still growing in it.
Okay, so these students are still, we don't have a full longitudinal group yet that's who have been exposed to one program.
Not yet.
For all the year. Okay, yeah, so yeah. That.
I believe we're in our fourth or fifth year, so.
Okay,
we,
so
we will in a couple
students,
years.
The students who didn't start with that have yeah. not had the full experience. Okay, thank you.
So if you look on page 5, and again, mm-hmm. these are just my inklings about this or my ponderings about this. What I think is very interesting is you see the levels of green, the dark green meaning exceeds expectation,
right.
The lighter green meaning met end-of-year expectations. So, you know, the first line is district, and then you see K-1-2, very high, very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see it drop down in third, fourth, and fifth.
Right.
Again, our K-2 teachers really have two more years of training than our third through fifth grade teachers. We started this training my first year up in this department. That was 6 years ago. We also adopted the curriculum a year earlier than we adopted at third through fifth grade. So this is their third year in implementation in K-2 and second year of implementation in third through fifth.
And do you feel that staff has the appropriate training and professional development now in the upper grades?
I do. How we have continued that this year, you know, without the math TOSA leading the work, is we have two teacher leaders, and one of them is actually a trainer. She's a teacher in our district, but is a trainer for the Math Learning Center. And they're leading our group of math leads, which has a couple of representatives from each school side. They provide professional development directly to those leads. They take it back to the school site and present it during their staff development sessions, either at faculty meeting time or at their PLC on Monday morning. So we're keeping the thread going, and the overall is we're on the road to improvement. But I think this is about teacher efficacy.
Okay. And then lastly, I know we don't have this broken down by site, but I just wanted to be sure that we that I'm sure there's variation among the sites, and that the sites are receiving, if there's a site that has a particularly high number of students who are not where we would like them to be, that those specific sites are receiving the resources, training, whatever they need to really target their students adequately.
So let's start with the data. Each of our sites and each of our principals has detailed end-of-year data in their hands already that tells them by grade, by students, specific student group, how their students performed at end-of-year as compared to second trimester, first trimester a year ago. So they've got quite a bit of data to use. They're going to be sharing some of that data, highlights, with me and with Dr. Prater at their end-of-year evaluation. And they're going to start to kind of zone in on what are they thinking about, what are their next steps. We're looking together in my department at each of our sites, as well as at each of our identified student groups, to look at, are the resources in the right place? Are the supports in the right place? Do we need to think that through a little bit differently? We'll also do that when CASP results come. We look school site, we look grade level, we look student populations. We can go all the way down to the teacher level.
Okay, thank you. And, I would also just comment that I have spoken to a few teachers, elementary teachers, since the end of the year who attended the institute and just loved it. I mean, they were very impressed with the number of people who attended, and then the quality of what they learned. They were just kind of busting at the seams about what they were learning and how great they thought it was. So thank you.
Good. Thank you. They worked really hard. It was an intense week. The week after school gets out, and they were very dedicated and worked really hard.
Mr. Unger?
First of all, Amy, I want to thank you for the for some of the detailed information we have. I really specifically appreciated the charts showing the advance toward proficiency by the specific populations. I thought that was really interesting data. And in some cases, we're doing better, I think, than we thought we might be doing with certain subgroups. In other cases, again, this clearly shows that we continue to have an achievement gap and something that we're going to work on and that I think we're working on through our LCAP. When you talked about the data that's available to the principals with Mrs. Sheffer's question, does that include the different pieces of the tests identifying what are specific areas of strengths and weaknesses that the students have in specific classrooms related to specific topics that are being tested?
Yes and no. So yes, for math, they can go into Illuminate and look at the specific areas of that were covered in that assessment. For writing, it's an overall score. So to look at writing, you really need to go back to the students' work and see what their scores were.
Okay.
But those scores were all completed or assessed by the teacher, so they should have a very strong indication of it. For BAS, that's a one-on-one teacher assessment.
Right.
So the principal's going to see a score. The teacher's going to have the deeper understanding of that. And the SRI, as I said earlier, is really just a dipstick test right now to give you kind of a sense of who I need to dig deeper into and look more deeply at what their needs are versus who's sore and high.
So for writing, the student would receive an overall score on the rubric that reflects each of the particular pieces of writing that either exceeds, meets, or approaches.
It's an overall score, but when the scoring is done, they look at many different components and score each one of those components.
And so that information is available to the teachers.
Yep.
Okay. And do you see the common assessments? You mentioned this before, and I'm just curious about it. Do you see the common assessments that we're giving really reflecting what we know, what we think we're going to see on the CASP, understanding that we're never going to know what's on the CASP? We know general themes, but we're not ever going to know specifics. So do our district common assessments inform what we think might be stuff that's on the CASP?
That's the million-dollar question that we're trying to monitor very closely. The BAS, being probably the very best assessment that we give, doesn't give us that because it goes away at the end of second grade. The SRI, again, is that dipstick. So I would say no to the SRI because the SRI is a quick and dirty. It's vocabulary-based. It gives you only that first inkling for where a student's at in their literacy skills. The writing, absolutely. The writing does give us a pretty good indicator. We haven't done, but we certainly could, and it would be interesting to look at to match up how students do, although I will tell you the CASP writing assessment looks very different than our common assessment. But it would be interesting to compare the writing score with the common assessment score, and we could certainly do that. And then finally, the math, I think we're seeing a pretty close lineup, at least at first blush.
Are we using the, I forget what the terminology is, for the state practice tests? Are our classrooms using those state practice tests to also inform what the scores on the, what the areas that might need targeting on the CASP? And is that in addition to this? And is that, again, sort of a question we hear, can that be overwhelming? Does it look like too much testing at that point?
It absolutely can be overwhelming, especially during the third trimester of school. All of our sites are using the interim assessments to different degrees based on which site. What I can tell you is that the information that they receive from the results do not inform instruction. They give them very little information. But what it does give them is, okay, this is what it's like to take a test online with these drop-downs and these moving things. And especially for third graders, it's critical that they take interims. But we don't get a lot of really informative information that guides any kind of instruction yet.
Mr. Quisenberry.
Well, I have two things, too. One's a question, one's more of a comment. So the first one is, as we go through the professional development we've been going through for 6-7 years, and in writing, in the reading program, we've been piloting new programs, we've adopted new programs. What is your sense as far as the administrator's ability to go in and assess those? Do you find them extremely knowledgeable, and what's their part in that?
Well, I will tell you, just looking at last week, of the 4 days, we had 10 elementary principals there for the entirety of the Reading Units Institute. They understand clearly, and especially with the instructional coaches going back to the classroom, that their job as instructional leader is just back right up there on top. One of the topics that we're going to be talking about this Thursday when I meet with them is what we call the look-fors in reading. And this is information we've gotten from the Reading Institute about what should you be seeing in the classroom. What should the walls look like? What should the instruction look like? What should the kids be doing? What should the libraries look like? What should the engagement factors look like? We're probably getting our strongest support in reading. Math, we had the same thing through the Silicon Valley Math Initiative when we were involved in that, and writing was pretty similar. So they're getting a lot of information and practice in looking at this. It's still a daunting job to be knowledgeable in all areas as the principal, but it's a focus for us.
Thank you, and that's very reassuring. The other thing is just an observation. It's as we adopt these programs, I'm more concerned that that they're working rather than being that concerned about the CASP test or its predecessor, which was the SBAC, or is that they're sort of the same?
Same, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So
I don't remember the name of the last one.
As long as
the
pedagogy is good and teachers are practicing, administrators are evaluating teachers based upon that, I feel pretty comfortable that, you know, we're heading in the right direction. Thank you.
If I understood your comment earlier, Mrs. Shields, when you said they give us very little information about the test, is that to prevent teaching to the test? Is that why they do that?
I don't think so. I don't think that's it. I just think it's impossible, you know, on a statewide level to have an interim kind of assessment that's going to give, I mean, if they continue to expand it and give you more detailed information, then potentially it could. But right now, it just gives you, and Mrs. McGrath, if you remember the wording, I would sure appreciate hearing it, it's met or not met. It just doesn't give you a lot, you know, not met what? And what do I need to, it doesn't have that.
Not much to go by there. And along with Mr. Unger, I too like this, on page 6, the math trimester 3 assessment, the students meeting proficiency by specific populations. It's helpful to me, as I look at this, to see where, as we're allocating resources, where those resources are most needed. So to that extent, it's really very helpful. And this this is a very well-done presentation. Thank you. It's very clear, and appreciate your time. Was there anyone else that would like to comment? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mrs. Shields. And we are moving on to the Food Services Department report.
So one of the first things I told Ms. Primer when she took the job was, hey, take it slow. Your first year, and kind of get to know everybody, you know, your apartment, kind of move those directions. And so, all kidding aside, Erin has done a fantastic job this year, new to the department, moving us in the right direction. As a board member, I think the LCAP response from students a couple years ago was, hey, food service, you know, better meals, better things for us to eat. And so Erin has really propelled us, I would say, in that area. So I've asked her to kind of give the board a quick recap of what she's been able to accomplish this year, and we're very, very happy she's on our team.
Well, we can already say that we've had a taste of your work, Vito. You served us a wonderful dinner. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed. Thank you, everyone, for having me tonight. I am very excited to recap a very exciting year. It's hard to believe that it's only been a year. And as Ryan mentioned, I tend to move pretty fast. So I'm excited to share with you some of the highlights. It was very difficult to stick it all into one small presentation, but I'm very excited to share with you the highlights that we've achieved in our successes this year. So our food service update is about serving up nutritious and delicious food at San Luis Coastal. And I also put a little note on there that we are on Instagram. We have some interns that have been helping us with Cuesta College and Cal Poly, and they've been managing a fun page for us. So if you want to see more pictures, you can check us out at SLCUSD Food. I wanted to start tonight by really giving you a peek inside of our kitchen. Who is our team? What is food service about? I will tell you that I am very, very lucky in the sense that I have a fantastic team of people around me. At our elementary sites, at our secondary sites, in our central kitchen, Chef Anthony, my team has really stepped up to the plate this year. They have really taken pride in what they are producing. That's been a recurring theme in our department is we want to be proud of what we do. We want to be proud of the food that we serve, and we really want our kids to enjoy it. You can see by some of the smiling faces here that I think we've really met that goal this year, whether it's making things in-house from scratch, going out and talking with kids about the types of food that we're serving and engaging with them, and even receiving some accolades from some of the students saying thank you for the work that we've done. Next slide. All right, so a year in review. What we really tried to do this year was focus on quality food, really focus on good food. It sounds so simple, and it's a little bit complex in how we get there. We used a program called California Thursdays. This is a program that started with the Center for Eco-Literacy up in the Bay Area, and it's really about bringing local foods into our school districts, getting kids to understand where things come from and that they have a relationship with our food system. So the California Thursdays program started this past school year as every other Thursday, a way for us to really highlight where our foods are coming from. There aren't any specific rules other than do the best you can in the area that you're at. So we started with every other Thursday. In the next school year, we'll be moving to every Thursday. And we really try and find products and work with farms where we can highlight and feature some of the products that they have. We are incredibly lucky in our area to have such an abundance of fantastic produce, grains, even meats. Some of the farms that we've had a chance to work with this year are Candarian Organic Farm, local grains that are actually grown in Los Osos. We put Emmer Faro on our menu, and it was really exciting to have the farmers come out and really engage with the students about their products. Many produce companies that we've worked with, we had a Dragon Spring Farm from Cambria come out and do a local winter avocado tasting for our local fish taco days when we featured them at both of our secondary schools. On that particular day, we saw a 50% increase in participation at Morro Bay High and 20% increase at Slo High, which was pretty impressive. It's amazing to be able to find local fish to put on our menu, local grass-fed beef, and an array of produce that we've been able to find as well. We also work with Achievement House, which is over by Cuesta College, and they do a hydroponic growing platform where they're teaching adults how to grow hydroponically, and there's a fun little picture in there. We really try and get the students to see that there are many different ways to grow food and to consume food and really engage them with their overall food system. We believe that this is the best way to not only teach them about good food and where food comes from, but when we really engage them in this story about food and they understand that someone had to grow this, it takes time to grow things, there's patience involved with this, they understand because they're doing this in their school gardens. When you have that story of the love and the care that's put into food, it's now something that's really special that you want to enjoy as opposed to something that's just there that you don't have a connection with. That's where we see more food waste. So to have this connection to food, we've seen a decrease in our food waste as well. And the food's better, so who wants to throw that away? All right, so the next slide is a little bit about nutrition education. I mentioned that this is really important so that students understand not only where things are coming from, but that they're a part of this process. There's a trustee, where's Waldo hiding in one of these pictures? And it was really exciting to have you guys come out and really see firsthand that this is really fun. What we've done with nutrition education is we'll take a local product, and I'm telling you, we've tried everything from Caracara oranges to arugula and edible flowers, and the kids have tried them and loved them. What's fun is that they get to vote. So again, that engagement in the process, similar to what they're seeing in the classroom, is able to happen at lunchtime. So we've done voting. They get get to choose love it, like it, or not today. We don't frame anything into a I hate it, I don't like it, I don't want it, because we think that as our taste buds grow and change, we may like it on another day. So sometimes we'll get kids to try something that they may not normally say that they like. And we've also done Battle of the Produce. We were at a walk-a-thon at one of our local elementary schools, and we battled carrots and cucumbers. The secret was that everyone won, but it was really fun to see kids get really excited about trying these things, getting to express their vote on which one they think should win. It's a really fun way to have a healthy food experience. And you can also see that there's some local farmers that come out as well and join us for this. So as we've really embarked on partnering with local farms and farmers and not only wanting to get their products into our cafeterias, we also ask them if they have interest in the education aspect. Many of them do, and they're so proud to not only bring students out for field trips, but to come onto campus and be able to talk to them about how they grow things and what they grow. And the kids get really excited and ask them some really fun questions. All right, so now how do we do this? Let's get down to the nitty-gritty and the financial piece. I also wanted to say, I didn't include this in my slide, but one of the important things that changed this year for us is that we were able to successfully negotiate the end of food service bidding. It's something that's gone on for a really long time in our department around how we get jobs each year, and we were able to successfully negotiate the end of that. So that was very exciting. Last year, when I started, it was a little bit daunting when I looked at our fiscal performance. We lost about $300,000, and we saw a pretty sharp decline in participation. So when I first started, I asked a lot of questions about why that was the case. And I found that we did a lot of things that were very easy. We did a lot of things that didn't require a lot of cooking or a lot of labor or a lot of time. And the quality of the food was something that I heard a lot from students and from staff. So when we looked at, why is this happening and how do we change that, we really thought, let's go back to some very simple ideas. The simplest idea is we need to serve good food to kids. If we can serve good food to students and they like it and they enjoy it, they're going to want to participate with us. An increase in participation means an increase in revenue and more money for us to put back into the program to serve good food to kids. So in a very simple way, it really is about good food, and food really does matter. So by focusing on real, good, freshly prepared food in-house, we've been able to increase our participation across the board. This year, we are projected to lose less than $100,000. We're still crunching our June numbers, so I didn't want to put anything that was too grand. So I feel very comfortable saying it will be less than $100,000 this year, and we do expect to be back in the black by next school year. So it's a pretty sincere turnaround. A two-thirds turnaround in just a year is pretty impressive, and truly it's because we've had this focus on really good quality food. We were also winners of a fun contest. Barilla Pasta did a photo contest on Instagram and Facebook, and this was our team with the check. We won $500 for our spaghetti and meatballs, which was really exciting, and we've been able to purchase some more equipment for the kitchen. So we bought a Vitamix, we have some new cutting boards, and some more fun gadgets that get to go back into the program. So the nice thing about our fiscal performance is that we are truly intended to be a break-even department. We're really, it's very odd as a business sense person to say that we're not here to make money, but we're not. The money that we get to bring into our program truly allows us to buy better things, to buy more fun things, to buy more equipment, to have more staffing, to really put it back into the program. So when you see the food service department doing really well, you can rest assured that those things are going right back into our students' bodies. All right, so the next slide I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on. This one was really fun. So this year, as part of fifth grade curriculum, it's actually more than just this year, but this year when I came on board, I was contacted by a number of different classrooms, fifth grade classrooms, and they said, as our food service director, can you come and talk to us about chocolate milk that's served in schools? I thought, well, that sure sounds easy. I would love to do that. And I thought first, let me go to our wellness policy and look at what our policy states. And our current policy supports the USDA's policy, which says we must offer two types of milk. Our current practice is a little bit different than what our policy states. So the policy is a little bit vague and a little basic. And the practice is that at the elementary schools, we offer two types of milk, and they're both white milk. So we have a fat-free white milk and a 1% white milk. At the secondary sites, we offer a fat-free chocolate milk and a 1% white milk. So you can only have chocolate milk when you get to middle school or high school. But that practice is not in line with the policy that we have written. It's just not clarified. The policy is just a little bit more basic than that. So when I went to the classrooms and spoke with students, they shared with me their research. They shared with me their ideas and recommendations for what they would like to see in schools. And we also talked about this at the Wellness Committee. And this is a very hotly debated issue. We probably could have a whole presentation just about chocolate milk. Basically, the way that I feel about it is we need to have it solidified in policy. Whatever the decision is, I will support. But I think it's very important that we have it solidified in our board policy. It's very hard to engage with students and reference policy that's not reflective of what the practice is. So first and foremost, I would like to have a board recommendation for solidifying what our policy would be. Then when we looked at, okay, well, let's compare apples to apples or milk to milk, the milk that's served in school is different than the milk that you buy at the grocery store. Because of the rules and regulations from the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, there are regulations around nutrients such as calories, fat, added sugar. So the chocolate milk that we serve in school has been reformulated. There is 4 grams more sugar in the chocolate milk as opposed to the white milk. There's naturally occurring lactose in the white milk, so we subtract that from the chocolate milk, and we're left with 4 grams of sugar. When we look at what 4 grams of sugar is or means, that's less than juice, that's less than a bowl of cereal. So putting into perspective how much more added sugar, I think, is an important piece to this puzzle. The other important piece is that we currently don't allow it in elementary schools. There are many school districts who have full allowance, where they have it for breakfast, for lunch, and there is a lot of concern about added sugar in milk and if that is something that we want to have into our students' bodies or not. So that's another piece to this, is that if we currently are not allowing it, maybe we solidify that and then have that be something allowed at the secondary school sites. The other end of the pendulum swings and says, well, it's really about nutrition and how do we get students to put these things into their body. When we look at the nutrients that are in milk, there's 9 essential nutrients that students would have to otherwise get from other areas. So eating more spinach and bananas and these other fruits and vegetables and products, that we're not seeing an increased consumption of those things. So the milk does provide a very easy way for the students to consume those important nutrients. And the flavored milk with the 4 grams more sugar, they get kind of excited about it. So, you know, really looking at, is this something that is going to encourage consumption and to encourage students to drink more? I think it's a very relevant issue for us to consider. Based on the information that I received from our fifth grade population and the wonderful letters that they wrote and debates that we've had in class, we've talked through all of these parts of the issue. We've talked through what the right thing is. For me as the food service director, the most challenging part of this issue is that when I put something in front of a student and I say, this is good for you, this is something that you should consume at school, the message then becomes, well, this is something that I should consume at home. So it makes it very difficult for me to put chocolate milk in front of them and say, at school this is okay, but at home, be careful. It may be a different product. And this is not just with chocolate milk, but many other products as well. I like to call them copycat snacks or copycat items because they look very similar to what you would buy in the store, but they are very different because they're reformulated to meet the needs of our program. That, to me, is the most difficult piece about this issue. How do we set the tone for, at school, it's one way, but at home, it's another? So education in this is very, very, very important. Fifth graders, much easier to understand than maybe a first grader. The recommendation, based on all of this research and data, would be to allow flavored milk 1 day a week at lunch only for the elementary schools. A win for them in the sense that they would like to be able to have this choice, but limited because we don't have it at all right now. I think it would be too much to say we should have it every day for both breakfast and lunch. Fundamentally, I think chocolate for breakfast sends a mixed message, so I would not recommend having it as a breakfast option. We also would recommend keeping current choices at the secondary schools, the 1% white milk and the fat-free flavored milk, and keeping all flavored milk fat-free. This is another fun button right now in school food. Secretary Perdue recently recommended for next school year to allow flavored milk to be 1%. And what we've learned is that whatever the USDA rules are, we must abide by them, but our local policy can be stricter. So my recommendation would be to keep all milk that's flavored to be fat-free and to not allow the 1% option at this time. The graph over here looks at our total milk consumption. So we were looking at white milk versus chocolate milk. What we actually did was a week of research. So there was a week, the last week of April, we wound up doing just a study on how much milk was consumed. White milk, fat-free, and 1%. And then the following week, we substituted the fat-free flavored milk with the fat-free white milk. So this is the data based on that that week and that research. We saw a 100 to a 350% increase in total milk consumption. What that tells me is that when flavored milk is offered, more kids are going to drink it. When flavored milk is not offered, students choose not to drink it. So the issue becomes, is it better for us to allow a little bit of sugar, that 4 grams more per carton, for a special treat and have the kids drink it, or do we say, no, we don't want that, and we allow them to not drink it at all? That's truly what the issue becomes.
On the days that we serve the flavored milk,
yes.
Did we also see an increase in school lunch purchases?
Yes, we did.
So your proposal is one day a week. The chart, however, is based on how many days a week?
The chart was a full 5 days a week.
Full 5 days a week.
Yeah. But looking at what the, I mean, truly, I think we would see a tremendous amount more consumption if we offered it every day. My concern is that we've gone from not having it all and going completely in the opposite direction, I don't think would be the best choice for us. To be completely fair, our wellness committee is very torn on this issue. I've got some members who are very adamant that they don't want to see it at all, and I have other members who say, yeah, let them have it every day if it gets them to drink more milk. So I think this recommendation really puts us at a very nice compromise. It's a very nice medium to say there is data that shows that the kids will be drinking more milk, which is, again, getting them those essential nutrients, but limiting it in a way that is not going too far board in the additional sugar or sweetened beverage.
So, Erin, I'm really excited about the one-day-a-week compromise. We've had lots of discussions about chocolate milk.
Yes, we have.
And specifically about how do we get parents to understand the difference between. But, you know, when I look at this chart, and it just dawned on me, some of the largest spikes in this chart appear to be in our Title I schools or our schools mm-hmm. with certain subgroups mm-hmm. involved. And that concerns me a little bit. So, again, I think the one-day-a-week compromise is good because, you know, we're finding in the United States that in some cultures and in some socioeconomic levels that the substitute of sugar to get kids to eat is prevalent, and I'm wondering whether this reflects that. So, again, kudos on the one-day-a-week, and I really appreciate your doing that, then the food service, the concern you're showing. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I do think that this is reflective of students of what they're used to consuming at home. So in many ways, I do think that some of these school sites, we have students who just are used to consuming that at home. So it's something they're more familiar with at school. And I am very cautious about having too much added sugar. But I do think if sugar is the issue, there are other products that we should highly consider that do not have the nutrients that the milk would offer.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. And I appreciate your presentation. And it sounds pretty complicated. And since this requires a board policy amendment, then I would suggest that staff, working with Erin and her staff, come up with an amended board policy for us to consider. And it could provide the complex information that you've shared with us a glimpse of so far.
And tonight, I just wanted to, again, it's not for the board to vote tonight on this. It was just, this is the big item. It was in a lot of newsletters. Parents were talking about it. Kids were talking about it. So I wanted her to kind of bring the board up to date on kind of where we stood with the information and facts and working with the kids. And I think this all stemmed from a writing.
Yes.
So from a curriculum discussion is how this all came about.
I thought it was, and so yes, there will be formal policy that will follow this, but this is to just start thinking about and really resonating what questions do you have about this type of policy change. What came to light was that, number one, our policy wasn't reflective of our practice, and number two, that students really want to be engaged in this. This was a topic that I thought was safe. I thought there was not going to be this hot debate, and it was really engaging to see them so excited about this. I had teachers follow up with me saying that this particular lesson was the most engaged they've seen their students all year. And I just think that's really exciting for them to see democracy in action. And if they really want to research a topic and become well-versed in it and talk to the right people in a professional and an appropriate way, that they can be part of change and seeing things happen in their school district. All right. Couple more fun things. Mm-hmm. All right. So another topic that relates to price and some things we're going to need to ask of you this evening is around our meal prices. Our meal prices, compared to other school districts in the area, are a little bit low. So later this evening, we are going to ask you to help us with a proposed 25-cent increase for our elementary breakfast and lunch, our secondary lunch, and our adult lunch pricing. This would bring us closer to what the other school districts in our area are charging, and it will allow us to generate more revenue so that we can purchase more quality local better foods that will be freshly prepared in-house. This is more informational than the ask just yet. All right, so what is next for food service? We've had quite an eventful year, even more to come. One of the things that we are working on right now are better burgers. Part of the discussions that I've had with the local fifth graders and some of the classes that I visited, they are very quick to let me know the things that are their favorite and the things that are not their favorite. I was a little bit surprised to hear that the burgers, not so much their favorite. And after we asked a little bit more about what that meant, it really became a quality issue. So we are working with a local meat purveyor, the Larder Meat Company. They serve a number of restaurants in our area. They have a home delivery service, and they purchase local cows, and they have them processed locally. We're looking at blending the rules with this one. That would mean how do we afford this better quality beef? Well, one of the ways would be to purchase local mushrooms and to blend the mushrooms with the beef to have a bigger, juicier patty, and we're going to serve that up on some local bread. So a total local burger is coming up next school year. We're also moving to whole muscle chicken products, so chicken nuggets, chicken tenders, chicken sandwiches. This is a breaded chicken drumstick that was on the menu today at summer school. Whole muscle chicken products, products that when you taste them, you go, wow, this tastes like real chicken. The alternative is pressed chicken, and pressed chicken is just, it tastes different. So we're going to move away from pressed chicken, and we are only going to be offering whole muscle chicken products next school year. We think that will be a nice increase in our participation as well. Chef Anthony won the Mac-Off on KZOZ, if anyone heard that the other week. He competed with his Mac Daddy recipe, and he won, which was really exciting, so we were very, very proud of him. And next week, I'm actually headed to Washington, D.C. I will be speaking on Capitol Hill about farm-to-school and local food purchasing. It is in support of H.R. 1241. It's a bipartisan bill that really looks at buying American and domestic products for our schools with our federal funds. So I'm really excited to be able to speak about San Luis Coastal and share about the successes that we've had.
And so Aaron was nice enough to, or mean enough, to have me participate as a local stakeholder in a study on sodium. Mm-hmm. And I just, to the, just right to the meat, that's interesting. Right to the hamburger and the chicken issue in the research I did leading up to this. I'm not sure about the hamburger meat, but definitely in the processed chicken, the sodium, they keep it, they preserve it, they soak it in sodium. And so just, again, kudos, because by going to more and more local stuff, not only are we increasing nutrients and the quantity of food and the quality of food, but we're also reducing the sodium level as well, if I've got that right.
Yep, okay. While benefiting the local economy. All good stuff.
Yeah, it's all good stuff. Thanks.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Your enthusiasm is really infectious. It's wonderful to see someone so enthusiastic about their job and making all these great changes that benefit kids.
Thank you.
I'm truly impressed. I either want to work for you or, I don't know, I want to just be with you all the
time.
We
have kitchen jobs open as we speak, so I'm teasing. Thank you. I absolutely love this. I feel like it's the best, most fun job in the world, and it totally rocks, so... Thanks.
Well, all of the changes look fabulous. I would ask, I wonder if you could, this big brouhaha around milk, mm-hmm. The 4 grams of sugar that are in the non-fat chocolate milk, what could you compare that to? Like, say, a cup of sugar cereal would have how many grams? I don't expect you to know all these things off the top of your head, but 4 grams is really a very limited amount of sugar, isn't it?
It's very small. Yes, I think there were more grams of sugar in my gummy vitamin that I took this morning. So
in your vitamin?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Very small amount. And when you look, I think the easiest thing to compare would be to juice, because even though they're not nutriently compatible, it's a beverage that you would consume for breakfast, which is kind of the same.
So if you had 8 ounces of milk versus 8 ounces of orange juice or apple juice or grape juice...
And we won't even serve you 8 ounces of juice because of the sugar content. We cut it to a 4-ounce serving. So when you compare an 8-ounce volume to a 4-ounce volume, and that 4-ounce volume still has more sugar, that 4 grams in the chocolate milk is pretty nominal when you look at a comparable beverage.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and good luck in the coming year.
Thank you. I can't wait. More to come.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Aaron, I join in Marilyn's remarks. I love the energy and excitement you've injected, and you and your team have injected into food service. And I'm hoping, as you shrink the deficit, that we can return to the halcyon days that perhaps only Chris and I remember.
1977.
But it used to be a cash cow, food service. And then the government got involved in telling the kids what they couldn't eat. Next thing you know, we're in the red.
Well, it all became cardboard.
That's right. So keep up the good work, and I'm looking forward to seeing us back in the black again.
Definitely.
And even if we only get close, it's impressive to see the foods that the kids are going to be eating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mrs. Shepherd?
I have a question that came to mind during your wonderful and informative presentation, and that is, with the involvement of the local growers, how did that come about? How did you make that happen?
Sure. So I've always been very passionate about working with those in my local community from the previous school districts that I've worked at. And when I came down here, I actually started a class last summer with the UC GNE program through the UC Co-op extension. I took a garden nutrition educator class so that I could learn how to participate with school gardens and find other like-minded volunteers in the community, really to have them come and work in our school gardens. And I met some incredible people. I met those through the County Office of Education. I met those with the Slow Food Coalition, really connected people within our community, and started attending their events and networking with them. There was a farm-to-buyer mixer that took place a few months back, and it was a really fantastic way for local farms and farmers to set up booths of information about their products and what they offer. And it was at that event that I was able to connect with so many local farmers and start this conversation and say, hey, we would like to have your food and served in schools. That's how we met the larder meat company, and it was a really interesting conversation where I said, I'd love to have grass-fed beef on my menu. I don't think I can afford it. And he let me know that when he purchases the whole cow and he processes the prime cuts that go to all of the restaurants, he's left with ground beef and stew meat that's still of an exceptional quality, but he doesn't have a market for it. And I said, I'm your market. So it's finding those partnerships and willingness to work with farms and farmers where they're at. It's just been an incredible adventure of finding, going and visiting these local farms, I was sharing earlier that we actually have farms that are currently growing things for us, and I've never been a part of that, which is just really exciting to know that we have some of the best products that are not only available to us but being grown for us. I think it's a really incredible statement, and it just goes back to the benefit of our local economy. We want to keep more dollars here in Slo County, and we can do that by having such an abundance of products and fantastic relationships with those who want to be able to get them into our schools.
Thank you. And that sort of goes with, I was curious about what the cost, the cost comparisons are to how we used to purchase, how food services used to purchase food, and purchasing locally, if you are able to make it comparable, or it sounds like in some cases better.
Yeah, I think it's important to know right off the bat that it is more expensive, and to not be afraid of that, because when we're able to serve more students and have an increase in participation, it offsets those costs. Right. What we saw happening was when we purchased foods that we thought were easier or cheaper, they actually aren't always cheaper, because when you pay something to come in process, there's a cost associated. But the secret, like we talked about in the beginning, is it good? If it's good, it will work, and if it's not good, it's not going to work. So what we had when I first started a year ago were 15 different types of packaged processed pizza in our freezers. And I said, okay, great, which is the good one? They said, not one. So we no longer buy packaged processed pizza because it's not good. And instead what we've done is we make a house-made pizza. We get a locally sourced naan bread that's from California Lavash up in Gilroy. We sauce it and cheese it, and it's baked once. It's a fresh product, and the kids really like it. So all of the questions that we have in the kitchen truly are around, is it good? If it's not good, it's not worth us doing. And when it is good and it costs more, we are very careful. But it's important that we know that spending a little bit more will yield us so much greater results. Because when we have good food and we have better food, and a lot of it's local food, more kids want to eat that. More kids want to purchase that. Therefore, we get more money coming from whether it's mom and dad or from our reimbursements. More participation equals more money for our program. So I'm not afraid of things costing more as long as they're good and we see that increase in participation.
Well, it looks like it's already proving to be effective.
Yes.
Because of the greater participation and the lesser amount that were in the red. So
yeah, and less waste, because when students want something and it's not something that they're being forced to consume, it's their choice to be able to eat it, we're finding less goes in the garbage can as well. So it really is a win all the way around.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
So I think one of the interesting things that's happened on the national level, during the Obama administration, there was a strong push toward increased and positive nutritional benefit to school lunches for students. That's been rolled back under the current administration. Anecdotally, one of the reasons that we've heard is, well, kids weren't eating healthy food. They were throwing healthy food away. You were requiring that they eat good stuff, and they didn't like it, and so why bother, right? Why not get back to the high caloric, high salt, high sugar foods? I think what you're proving is that it is possible to have really healthy, tasty food that's nutritional, that's nutritious, that students will eat. This is important stuff. What we do with our kids, and I think your attitude about create a relationship with food that is healthy. Mm-hmm. It's a supplement to our PE program. Our PE program is a supplement to what you're doing, because they're both talking about healthy kids and what can we do to make healthy kids. And by the way, let's have it be a cost-neutral program. And that benefits everybody. And the more money you have, the more you can do. Mm-hmm. I was shocked and pleasantly shocked to walk into the kitchen and actually meet Chef Anthony and to see the things that Chef Anthony is doing. I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined a school district would have a chef that's creating things that's treating our kitchen like it's a restaurant instead of an institutional kitchen, you know. So I just applaud you guys. And I just want to end with, when I was a kid, and I think those of you of a certain age will remember the advertising slogan, helps build strong bodies 12 ways. Everybody remember that? You remember what it was? It was Wonder Bread. And I don't think that Wonder Bread actually helped build strong bodies 12 ways, but I think the things you're doing are. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I just want to ask you to share a little secret with us. We won't tell anybody else, but what's in the Mac Daddy recipe?
So the Mac Daddy is not a school-compliant recipe, but we are interested in making it a school-compliant recipe. The Mac Daddy has three kinds of cheeses. There's a habanero cheddar, so there is a bit of heat to it. There is crawfish in it, or crawdads, which made it the Mac Daddy. He also added some snow crab and candied bacon and a breadcrumb topping. That was really killer.
Not quite
school food compliant, but we can definitely make anything compliant, and I think that's been the best learning for us over the last year, is that, you know, when we cook with real ingredients and real foods and we really focus on just having good food for kids, it's bigger than a politicized topic. It's bigger than which administration is doing which thing. It's about having really good food for our kids, and I think everyone can get behind that. The last thing I'm just going to end on is that with all of these fantastic things that we've just talked about this evening, we've come up with a new logo for our department, and this is it, and it's Food Matters, because I think that really speaks to what we're trying to do. So you'll see a lot more of our Food Matters logo in the future. Thank you, everyone.
Love it. Thank you. Try to top that, Mr. Pinkerton.
Hey, I hired her. I actually, we met at a CASB, so I went to the CBO. They have a thing for business officials every year, the big symposium academy. So I went, and I purposely went to some food service seminars to try to find food service people. That's where I met her. That's where I found Erin. So we are very fortunate, as you can tell, to have her on board. So this next board item kind of goes a little right along with that. Erin talked to you about it a little bit. We have increased costs both with staffing, food costs that are going to accelerate over the coming years. And yes, she's done a wonderful job with trying to increase enrollment, those types of things. But we definitely need to kind of maintain a certain level of cost as well in terms of price. So we are asking the board, and I think the last time we were here was about 2 years ago, where we increased a couple of the items, but not the elementary. So we're just kind of bringing everything up to par. I think we're very competitive in terms of all areas. And as any of you know, when you go to the grocery store, the cost of groceries these days. And so it's, you know, the fact that they can serve and do it for these prices is really a remarkable thing.
Okay. This is an action item. Oh, Mrs. Sheffer.
I just want to confirm or receive confirmation publicly. This will not affect our free and reduced lunch students.
It has no effect.
Thank you.
Okay.
Having said that, I would... are there more comments?
Walter, sorry.
I'm just going to move the thing. Oh, I mean, let's get going here, folks.
That's what I was going to do. So I would, no further comments, I would move to accept the increased cafeteria meal prices.
We have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Passes 7-0. Thank you. And moving on to item number 8.04. This is the approval of the 2017-18 Consolidated Application Part 2. Mrs. Shields.
So the California Department of Education requires the consolidated application for funding categorical programs to be submitted annually. The first part we complete in February, and the final part is completed in June for your approval. The comprehensive application covers three federally funded programs, Title I, Title II, and Title III. Title I funding is intended to meet the educational needs of low-achieving students enrolled in the highest poverty schools. Our district's Title I funds have historically been allocated to our six elementary schools with the highest number of socioeconomically disadvantaged students. For the 2017-18 funding cycle, there was a slight change to the regulations. Schools with 75% or more socioeconomically disadvantaged students are required to receive Title I funding. And based on this change, Pacific Beach High School will now qualify and therefore receive a Title I allocation for 2017-18. In past years, we have excluded Pacific Beach due to their alternate funding source, but that exception is no longer a possibility when we're completing the form. Title II is the second area, and this is federal program designed to improve teacher and principal quality through professional development and teacher recruitment. And Title III is specifically designed to assist English learners in acquiring English and achieving grade level standards and graduation requirements. The funds are meant to supplement the work and funding the district spends with general budget dollars. San Luis Coastal is eligible to apply for an estimated $981,018 in categorical funding for 17-18. The application has been reviewed and approved by our District English Language Learner Advisory Committee, as well as our District Title I Advisory Committee, and I'm seeking your approval tonight to submit the application.
Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. So, as I was reading this, I noticed that the private schools in our community are relying on a public school, San Luis Coastal, to put forward their application, if I've got this right, monitor their money, mm-hmm. and do their program. So I just find it interesting that, you know, without the public schools, some of the private schools wouldn't be able to benefit from some of the things that are happening for children. The second thing is, and it's probably just a small thing. When I was looking at the application on page 7, down at the bottom, there's each school. Del Mar has their plan, but at Hawthorne is the one where it actually mentions parent spending money on parent site for low-income families, develop a preschool program on site for low-income families with an emphasis on parent education, and that's one of my big deals. And so is this something where each site gets to decide how to spend their money, and has Hawthorne decided to spend it on parent education? Specifically?
No, part of the federal funding for Title I is each site designates 1% of the funding for parent education.
Okay.
I actually write the highlights up for each site, but all sites are required to have parent participation as part of it.
Okay. And then because we do basically manage the money, is there some benefit to us financially for Ben?
Federal law that requires that we offer out eligible schools, and these are nonprofit private schools within our district boundaries, Title I funds in the way of Title I, Title II, and Title III. We do manage the funds in my department. They aren't actually given an allocation. They, based on their student numbers, they turn in a plan that I approve. They all receive Title II dollars because you don't have to do anything above and beyond. You don't have to show socioeconomic student need. You don't have to show English learners at your school. So all of the non-private schools do request funds from Title II. They fill out a plan. I approve each of their POs or conference requests. It's certainly a lot less money than what our district receives. It's based on the number of students at their school site.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
But I didn't answer your question. And we do receive centralized funds to manage that with those districts that we keep.
And if I remember correctly, those funds amount to about 1%. Am I right? It was in here somewhere.
I don't remember.
It's a minuscule amount for what it sounds like a lot of work that you're doing. And I appreciate
work.
It, Amy.
Yeah, okay.
Mrs. Roger?
Thank you. If there's no further discussion, I'd like to move approval.
Actually,
do you have discussion?
Yeah, if I may, please. I just want to point out that how important Title I money is to our schools that qualify for Title I funding. And I see here that our approximate Title I federal funding is about $661,000, something like that. I just did a quick calculation, and if I'm assuming that close to 40% of our students are free and reduced, something like that, is that pretty accurate?
Mm-hmm.
How much? 36%. It comes out to a little more than $200 per student, something $225, $230 per student. And just I want to point out to the public how minuscule that is, and how important this money is to us. And as there's discussion in Washington, D.C. about cutting some of these funds, I think we need to say no. It hurts our students and it hurts our communities.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Unger.
Chris, do you want to move it?
No, go ahead. I don't care. You already moved it.
Do we have a motion?
And so would you like to be the second?
I'll second.
I didn't get it all out of my mouth, but that's okay if you heard me move it.
Okay. We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Well, I spent about 3 hours with the board last Thursday at our study session reviewing the intricacies of lease-leaseback agreements. And they were good hours. And so it's important, I think, for the board to understand, you know, when these contracts come in front of them, what they mean and what you're voting on. So that said, we do have some contracts to award tonight. Hopefully, we did our RFQ, RFP, selected Acme Construction as the best value for us. Not only did they meet all of the criteria that we had set, but they were also the low price. So it's really a win-win for us in these cases. So the first approval I'm asking the board tonight is to issue lease-leaseback contract agreements for the Morro Bay High School Student Services Building, as well as the track and field.
Mrs. Sheffer.
If there is no further discussion after our detailed meeting last week at the Measure D study session, I would move awarding contracts for RFQ/P number 286 for Morro Bay High School track and the Student Services Center.
And after acknowledging Mr. Pinkerton and Mr. Holcomb's tutelage of me yesterday because I wasn't able to attend the Measure D meeting, I can actually say I get it now. So I second.
We have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 7-0. Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so the next is award of contracts for San Luis Obispo High School projects, and the two projects we're bringing in front of you, or three projects tonight we're bringing in front of you, is the new gym modernization, the student services / performing arts space center there, and the Slow High swimming pool. And again, we're not necessarily ready to start construction on these, but by bringing the contractor on board, we can do the pre-construction services, get that going, so they can actually have a really good say in terms of value engineering and constructability and really tying into how we're actually going to construct these with the architect, get that into the plans before they're approved through the Department of State Architects.
Is there any discussion? Mr. Quisenberry.
Having had lots of prior discussion, as mentioned before, I move the approval of the Measure D award contracts for the RFQ/P number 285 for San Luis High School.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mr. Quisenberry and a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 7-0.
So the next two items on the agenda are really just asking the board for us to go out for an RFQ, RFP for a couple of other projects that we have moving forward that are currently architects are working on in terms of those plans. And the first one we'll ask the board to vote on tonight is the Bishop's Peak new multi-purpose room, as well as the modernization of the current multi-purpose room into a new office. And so Bishop's Peak was one of the schools that was kind of left out with our last kind of tax override. And so this is kind of bringing that school up to date with some of our other school sites.
So, again, having had extensive discussion on this at this study session, I'd like to move the authorization of a lease-leaseback delivery method RFQ, RFP number 291 for Bishop's Peak. And I'd like to just add that a lot of what we heard and a lot of discussion was based on the traffic flow, which has been such a problem at Bishop's Peak over the years. So
we hope to help that.
I'd like to move approval of this item.
There is a motion by Mr. Buckman and a second by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That passes 7-0.
The next one is Bellevue Santa Fe. So same thing. So this is to put out a request for qualifications proposal for us to go out and find a lease-back contractor to assist us with the Bellevue Santa Fe project. That is a project that we're looking at modernizing the classroom buildings there, as well as kind of fingers crossed about state funding to do some other work in the main office, restrooms, and other areas. So this would, again, go out to just get that selection process going. We would be doing a best value selection, bringing that eventual selection back to the board for approval.
I'm looking at Mr. Millar. Is your light on?
Well, why not?
Yeah.
After that extensive discussion that you guys had mentioned to me and I had yesterday, I will move approval of the request for RFQ on project number 292 for the Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School Modernization Project.
Second.
We have a motion by Mr. Millar with a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Passes 7-0.
Looks like my last item is actually, we've talked a lot from the board, so we had set some priorities when we initially had established the bond and Measure D projects, and so some of those priorities were kind of a tier two after the two high schools. That was Bishop's Peak, Sale Smith, Pack Beach, as well as Bellevue Santa Fe. And so we have kind of gone out to receive some charter funding it was actually part of the state bond, and we feel good about that. I actually heard from them today in terms of some further information they needed, which I got right back to them. And so we're very hopeful for that. Unfortunately, the Measure D budget that we had established didn't necessarily purchase the updated modular classrooms for the campus. And so what I'm asking the board tonight is really for us to allow us to move forward with those modular purchases. It's a little bit more than what we had. We're very hopeful, though, that the charter money, when it comes through, will pay for that, as well as actually pay for some of the other expenses that the board has already approved, like the architect fees and so on. So we're really working towards that. We feel good about it. If any charter school in the state of California should receive funding, it would be Bellevue Santa Fe. I mean, established charter for a long, long time with our district. We feel really good about it. So it's a win-win for that campus to bring it up to date and really for our kids. It's our campus, ultimately. It's our asset that they use. And eventually those kids mainly come to our campuses in terms of middle school and high school. So I am recommending that the board approve that. And so the reason why we have to come early is there's actually a construction timeline that we have to set with the manufacturer, that they actually build the portables over the wintertime. And so in order for us to be able to get this project done during the summer months, because that is their campus, we kind of have to bring it a little bit ahead to get that schedule going. So what I'm asking the board tonight is really just approval to move forward with the purchase of those. And we discussed this a little bit at the study session as well. But that kind of is a recap.
Mr. Quisenberry.
Just a comment and kind of a question. So regardless of which type of modular building that we would put on the site, there's going to be extensive grading.
Yes.
To have to be done in order to bring that above the the floodplain.
Yes.
That has to also be a part of the whole program, the whole purchase price. I mean, the whole cost to the district. That's what I should say. The whole
yes.
cost to the district. And by doing this, then that gets us ready to get that grading done and get these in by end of the summer 2018.
So our hope would be that would be a next summer project.
Okay, great.
So 2018, we would, we're actually going to work with Mr. Getz and the school about maybe ending a little bit early and starting a little bit later so that we can extend that timeline. So it's just having this kind of planning time available is huge.
Thank you.
Mrs. Sheffer.
I was just going to move acceptance of to approve the Bellevue Santa Fe construction schedule.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Quisenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much.
7-0. Moving on to item number 8.10. And that is going to be Dr. Prater.
Yes. As you all know, earlier this year, we approved a three-year agreement with all of our employee groups for 1% each year for 3 years. And the one group that did not receive that dispensation were the two assistant superintendents. And I'm asking tonight, in addition to their normal step-in column, that they would receive the additional 1% like all the other employees.
Thank you. Quick draw.
Okay, if there's no discussion, then I'll move approval of item 8.10.
Oh, I see. And we have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that passes 7-0. And moving on to item number 8.11. And this is our evaluation. As I mentioned in closed session, we had an evaluation of an employee, and this employee was our superintendent. And I am pleased to report that at the conclusion of this, we have identified his performance to be very satisfactory to us. And we would recommend a renewal of his contract. And I'll leave it to you to make a motion.
I move that we approve the executive contract extension for the superintendent.
Second.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Quisenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that passes 7-0. And we're now on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if there's any item you wish to pull. Item number 9.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Item number 9.02, approval of instructional calendar for 2018-19. 9.03, approval of Cal Card purchases. 9.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 9.05, approve dual enrollment courses. It's the second reading. 9.06, authorization for records destruction. 9.07, approval of field study trip requests. And 9.08, update district standards for managing environmental resources.
I'll move items 9.01 through 9.08.
I'll second. We have a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that takes us to the advanced agenda. Mr. Unger.
So the subcommittee for the board retreat met this afternoon, and one of the things that Dr. Eisendrath Rogers and Catherine did was to collect all the comments from the school, from the board members themselves, about potential topics for the retreat. In our discussions in the subcommittee, we felt, and if I get it wrong, I know you guys will jump in. I think there are a couple of things that really stood out for us. I think the very first thing that we need to accomplish and that I would recommend that we put on the agenda is the development of our goals and objectives for 2017-2018. And that will drive that will be our instructions to Dr. Prater, and that from which Dr. Prater will be evaluated. So that would be the very first thing that I think is the most important thing that we can accomplish in this retreat. The second thing that came up were, I think, some things that that were mentioned by several board members, and I think they're important because they relate to the way the board does its work and our processes and the way we look at how our processes are achieved. I think they really seem to relate to the agenda and how the agenda is developed. Not only
coming from the president clerk meetings, but also here. So I would like to recommend that certainly we talk about how we set the agenda on the retreat. Another thing that I think came up was a concern about if something gets on, and it relates to the agenda, if something gets onto the agenda, how do we follow up to make sure that it gets done? That was something that one of the board members felt was important, and I think that I personally think that's important too.
Could you clarify that?
Sure. One of the board members mentioned that there were some things that seemed to be agreed to as advanced agenda items, but that had not yet come forward either as a Friday packet or as actually an agenda item here. And so, just I think it's important. And going along with the how we do our advanced agenda that we talk about, is stuff getting done? Because to me, the way I would put this, I think these are trust issues with us. Making sure that the board is, that we all feel like we're getting a say in things, that we all feel like that the work of the board is supported by the board. That it's not just being decided on by a couple of people. So I think that's real important.
And Chris, can I just ask?
Yeah, absolutely. That's
so are you outlining an advanced agenda item that at which we will be able to discuss these things that you're talking about because we'll have it on the agenda?
What I'm proposing is that these be part of the agenda, that these two things for sure be part of the agenda of the retreat.
So it's an advanced agenda item.
That's
setting
right.
Items for the retreat.
For the retreat, yes, exactly.
I'm totally in support of that.
Okay. The next thing, though, there was a group of, everybody had different, almost specific interests in things that they wanted to see happen at the retreat. There were really a lot of them. And what I would propose we do is we do a survey, and you know, my I've never used it before. I've never created anything on it. But I would propose we do like a Survey Monkey kind of a thing with all of the topics that board members had an interest in. I would suggest that we prioritize, that we ask each of you to prioritize those items. If I would suggest that anything that really comes to the top that we try to put on the agenda for the retreat. Things that don't, I don't think we should ignore them, but I think the question needs to be, if they really don't fall to the top given the limited time we have, are these more appropriate to be either, really, is it real important to do it at the retreat, or should it be something that could be in a study session or a board presentation or even a Friday packet? Because I think if y'all put stuff down as important to you, I think we ought to find out if it's important to the other board members. And I'm proposing we do it in advance, because if there's work that Dr. Prater needs to do or the staff needs to do to prepare for those things, we really need to get it done, because the retreat's in about 3 weeks. So does that process sound okay to everybody?
Yeah, if I may, Chris, the only thing I would suggest is, based on your suggestion just now about kind of sorting those into those three buckets,
yeah.
is that at when we look at whatever we're going to be sent, that we might be able to indicate, you know, study session,
yes.
Friday focus,
yeah.
Or retreat, to
sure.
that we can make it clear at that time. And
okay.
sort those things out, and it may mean then later looking at all the things that have been put in those different
right.
categories and coming up with, is this as a full board, is this what we really want to do? Is there only, you know, one person who expressed
sure.
an interest in this, or did several? So
well,
we may take some more massaging on down the line,
yeah.
but at least for purposes of planning the retreat, which I understand time is of the essence in getting this. Getting this going.
So the way I was actually thinking about having it look would be, we would have the topic that was brought up by the board member, and I, let's say there were 10 specific topics brought up by the board members, because there were a number of them. I would propose, and we would just have to look at how many there are, but saying one, not even one through 10, but one through the number of items, just like they do at, you know, the pack. Is this your number one item?
Yeah.
And, you know, going down and going, this would be my number one item. Down here is my number 10 item, and including all of them. And then in addition, doing exactly what you talked about. Is this something that should be at a study session, at the board retreat? You know, do you really feel strongly that it should be at the board retreat? Is it something that could be a Friday packet? Is it something that... So I look at study sessions and as a separate meeting from a board presentation, and Friday packet as being third. So I would think we would offer those three things up, just to see take the temperature of the
board.
And
then when we receive this list, however you're sending it out,
will
at that time we have an indication of how many board members expressed an interest in a particular topic, because that will help me make a determination whether something may be really important to me. If no one else cares, then I'll think about it a different way.
You know, I suppose we could, but I will tell you that except for a lot of the stuff about the agenda, it was pretty all over the place. I mean, wouldn't you say, Mark and Catherine? I mean, there was everybody had something different. There wasn't a lot of duplication.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So I really want everybody to understand how this coalesced with the committee, and one of the points that we really looked at is how do we make everybody's comments of value and honor all those comments. So I think that this concept that we've come up with it really does accomplish that.
And if I can get Brian from ISMT to work with me, I can do the SurveyMonkey and use all of the categories that we've talked about in our little... Yeah. Thanks for volunteering him. Okay.
Okay.
I need a volunteer name.
So everybody's good with... Does that sound like a process that will get us where we need to be?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Thank you.
We've reached consensus on that. And any reports by board members?
I'm just going to real quickly. I think all of the board and most of us attended all of the graduations. They were great. The weather was great out in Morro Bay, except for the continuing need for sunglasses. I also like to mention that I was invited to the Bakari graduation, which is a program for extremely high-risk children, and I'm not sure how, but I was permitted to participate in the Cal Poly Black commencement exercises. So I just am always amazed at the support of our board for all the programs, especially PAC Beach. Just amazing.
Thank you, Mr. Ruckman. Seeing no one else, we will be adjourning and meet again at the board retreat, which is on the 11th of July. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
I have to apologize to Dr. Prayer. I didn't process the fact that I was going to be